when people are like, oh, I have elevated cortisol and I'm really stressed out and that's why I'm putting fat on, a lot of times, one, they're going in fasted and fasted training. So yeah, they will have elevated cortisol, but because they've gone in fasted and done some fasted training, they get really hungry later in the day and overcompensate. So again, when we start to break that idea of burning calories through exercise is allowing me to eat whatever I want or allowing me to have more treats in a day, you break that mentality, then it becomes much easier for people to assimilate good dietary practices and exercise for health.
What's up, my friend, and welcome back to another episode of the Legendary Life Podcast. I'm your host, celebrity trainer and high-performance health coach, Ted Rice. This is a podcast for men and women who are looking to boost their energy and upgrade their health. So get ready to learn proven health, fitness, and mindset strategies to unlock your full potential. And speaking of unlocking your full potential, this is a super important episode when it comes to training and nutrition, especially for women. For example, should women train differently than men? Should women approach nutrition differently than men? And if a woman is in the different phases of her menstrual cycle, should she do something differently with her training, nutrition, and lifestyle program? Or what about if she's in menopause? Those are the questions that we're going to explore and answer today with my guest, Dr. Stacy Sims. Dr. Sims is an exercise physiologist and nutrition scientist who specializes in the differences between men and women. So this is such an amazing episode. You're going to learn so much. Before I get to the episode, I want to share something with you. Here's the deal. To truly thrive in all areas of your life, you can't ignore the importance of good nutrition. What we eat affects everything from our energy levels to the amount of inflammation we have in our bodies to our immune system function. And do you want to know a secret that all of my coaching clients follow? Add veggies in each meal. But let's be honest, most of us don't eat the recommended servings of vegetables and fruits each day. So for those of us who are on the go or have trouble eating healthy, having a green powder makes it easy to get your greens in every single day, no matter how busy you are. And that's why I recommend Organifi Green Juice, a superfood powder that you just add to water so that you can get your greens in on the go. The best thing about Organifi Green Juice is that it actually tastes good. But don't believe me, try it for yourself. And use the code TED20, that's TED20, at www.organifi.com. That's www.organifi.com to receive 20% off your first order. But hurry, this is a limited time discount for Legendary Life listeners. All right, let's get to the episode with Dr. Stacy Sims. Dr. Stacy Sims, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
And I had to click record because we were already talking about things. It always happens with great guests. We always got to get off to a great start. And I'm like, all right, we got to stop and press record. And before we jump into too much, can you just briefly describe what it is that you do?
So the elevator pitch is hard. So I'll go with a little bit longer, like multi-talented, multi-tiered angle there. I'm a nutrition scientist and an exercise physiologist that specializes in sex differences. And I have one hand in research with high performance athletes and the other hand in the pure applied sports science aspect. So that's the overview, but on the undercurrent, I've been a professional athlete and I have been helping professional athletes longer probably than I've been an academic.
Very cool. And you even did some personal training working your way through school, which we talked about.
Yeah.
But what was really fascinating that I wanted to just jump right into, and sorry for rushing you through that, but I was like, we got to get back to this conversation because it's so important. We were just talking about how people who may not be familiar with your background, they look at you as an academic and think that you don't really know what you're talking about because you don't have the real world experience. But probably as you were coming up in with your real world experience that you did do, like you just said, you spent longer amount of time being an athlete and perhaps training athletes than you have spent being an academic, people are like, oh, you don't know anything because you don't, you know, you haven't published any research. So can you talk about that state of things in the fitness industry? Because a lot of people, like my listeners, don't know what to think about that situation. They don't know who to listen to, and they're confused by it.
Yeah. So, I sit back in academia. Like, I did my PhD, I got recruited, went to Stanford, worked at the High Performance Center at Stanford, and then translocated myself from that over to prevention research to get a little bit more into the public health aspect of research. So taking a lot of the applications we have in the high performance realm to the general population. So looking at things like cooling and exercises, building pre-fitness, how do you increase mitochondrial adaptations in people who are obese without overstressing them, trying to get them more comfortable. Got involved a lot with the Women's Health Initiative that was responsible for taking or recommending menopause therapy to be taken off the market. And then when I got pregnant, I also had the opportunity to launch a company, recreating or creating a new niche in sport nutrition on the low carbohydrate electrolyte drinks for pure functional hydration. So that was kind of a crossroad of, do I leave academia and go purely into industry, or what do I do? And at that point I was like, I can probably always get back into academia, but you don't have that opportunity very often for someone to say, hey, I love your ideas, let's fund it and bring it to market. But I don't recommend launching a company the month before you have your first child. It's not a very good idea. So yeah, did that, and then had the opportunity to come back to New Zealand because they were looking for someone to head up a research program and start one that was involving altitude and thermoregulation and nutrition science and that kind of stuff. So I popped over here to take that contract. And so now I'm back in academia half-time, and then the other half I'm still in the applied world. I'm still working with elite athletes, the women's rugby sevens here, a lot of individual professional triathletes and cyclists. So kind of a combination. And then when I sit in the research world, and I've heard this many times, so what do you know? Because you're just a PhD, or you don't publish enough. I publish enough to keep a high impact factor on ResearchGate from the applied angle, but not high enough to like fast track to professor tenureship. But that's not my interest. I'm not interested in doing research for research's sake. I'm interested in doing research to answer questions to be able to apply it to my athletes or the general population. And then, like you say, you know, when you're in the industry and people go, oh, you have a PhD, what do you know? You've never done anything applied. So I sit right in the middle and I kind of look at the research, the seminal research that's come out, and then the research that's built on top of it, and seeing what's evolved and what hasn't, to be able to pull back and say, well, this is media marketing taking this trend, and this is actually the new research that's coming out, and these are some of the questions that still need to be answered. And then I try to pull it all together in some sense to try to answer the questions and disseminate it.
Yeah, and thank you so much for that, because even me, I've been in the industry for 20 years this February right now as we're recording this. And it's been such a difficult road for me as a professional working, not working in research, but working with people all the time. And I've been down so many roads where, you know, I get great results with some people, but not others. Really couldn't figure out the difference until, I guess, maybe 10 years ago. Maybe I wasn't paying attention, I'm not sure, but it just seemed like the explosion in research, and it, all of a sudden there was just all of this stuff, this research is good research to dive into, and it's just been exponentially increasing since then. But I think about the people who are trying to figure this out who don't have a background in biology, or you know, they're getting some person who uses some sciencey terms. I mean, what would you say to someone, especially the women listening, because I feel like the industry in general kind of, I don't know if I'd use the word preys on women. Maybe you have a different, maybe you can speak more to that. Obviously, I'm not a woman. I can't speak to that from an experiential perspective, at least. But, you know, it kind of goes after women a little bit. and they don't know what to do. Tracy Anderson's, you know, don't lift more than 3 pound weights, or, you know, just do cardio all the time, or just do intermittent fasting, even though, you know, there's all these things that are kind of being told to women. And I feel like when I work with my women clients, they seem in general the most like ready to take action, but also kind of the most like, ah, I don't know what the hell is going on. I don't know who to believe. Can you give us your perspective on the state of things?
Yeah, I mean, for gosh, so many years, women have just been marginalized, like across the board in all industry. And now it's come up, you know, like here in New Zealand, they have this new initiative of women in sport and participation and equality. And then you have a whole bunch of exposés on female athletes. And so it's becoming this global phenomenon that women are not, shouldn't be marginalized. And within that, you're also having all these people go, oh, it's an untapped market. Let's go after this. But the undercurrent is a sociocultural aspect where women are very conscious of how they look and how they're supposed to look. And the best way I can describe is when you look at a typical American sitcom, right? You have the guy, he comes out in blue jeans and a long shirt that's kind of, it's not tucked in, and he's a bit overweight and he's the star of the show. And then you have the woman that comes out, is supposed to be his wife. Picture perfect, right? So Botox, super thin, has some muscle, is the supposed media ideal. And so women are held up to a higher standard. So when someone comes, we'll make you look like XYZ, we'll make you, you know, fit into this mold, women will grab onto it because of this undercurrent of this pressure and this self-doubt and the fact that women's bodies are so different and we respond differently to training that something might work for a friend but won't work for you. So then you're like, okay, well, that didn't work. Maybe someone else's advice will. Until they figure out their own cycle, their own physiology, how they respond because of this hormone perturbation throughout life, you're going to respond differently. And because that messaging really isn't out there, there's so many other things that are being pulled from male research. And we say, you know, shrink and pink for women, and then just thrown at women and saying, hey, you should try this. No, you should try that. Oh, no, you should try this because this works for that. And then you'll have, in this globalization of social media, people will come on and say, well, try this. This works for me. And they might be getting paid for it, or it might just have just worked for them. And when we're talking about from a professional standpoint, and you'll know this well, you don't ever approach a client and say, well, this worked for me, so we'll make it work for you, right? It's not about you. It's not about you as the professional. It's about your client. But I think that gets misconstrued a lot in the messaging that's out there. And people can't necessarily see it because we're so bombarded with messages all the time. And the basic premise comes down to kind of playing on that self-doubt or that, I guess, a little bit of lower confidence in body image and self-efficacy that women have. And it's a societal thing, really. I mean, because men are always told to be, oh, you're strong, you're powerful, you're fit. But then when you look at women in headlines, it always comes down to the female athlete has, you know, or women are unfit, or they have iron deficiency or bone problems, or they need to take this medication. But just the wording in media also perpetuates that.
Interesting. So I don't read a lot of media, so I can't really speak to that, but I'm going to try to pay more attention when I do get exposed to the headlines. So you're bringing up some really important things here. What I think would be important to go into, especially for the people listening right now, for the women listening right now, is to talk a bit about the differences. Like you mentioned, a lot of the research is done on men. And my understanding, or at least the way it was explained to me, is because a woman, to do research on women, you would have to kind of all have them in the same phase of their cycle, or else it's not the same research, right?
Yeah.
And that's just harder to make happen. I don't know if that's a cop-out or not, that it's harder to make happen, but I think it's important to understand for the women listening in particular, like a lot of that research is done on guys. And, you know, more research is coming out. Can you speak to that a little bit about the cycles? And then maybe we can translate into some practical considerations for the women listening about their training and how it should match up with their cycles?
Yeah, for sure. So after puberty, you know, you have the boys and girls are very similar, and then you have the onset of puberty, and men or boys lean up and they get stronger, fitter, faster because of testosterone, and women's hips widen. They start to put on body fat, all of the estrogen stuff that's coming out. And then we start into our menstrual cycle, and you have 2 weeks of low hormone, which is kind of then a rise in estrogen around ovulation. Estrogen starts to dip a little bit as progesterone comes up, and then you have 2 weeks of what we call the luteal phase. And this is from a physiological and biological standpoint when the uterine lining is becoming hospitable to, you know, a fertilized egg. But when we look at actually what's happening with us perturbations, you have 2 weeks of low estrogen progesterone. Then you have the elevation and then a sustainably higher baseline of estrogen progesterone until you have a sudden drop and start bleeding, which is your period. And the thing about estrogen progesterone is they're not just affecting reproduction. They're affecting so many different systems in the body. They're affecting our fuel system and our reliance on free fatty acids as opposed to carbohydrates. So it's harder for women to hit intensities. It changes the amount of water that's in our blood because it affects fluid balance. Women have a greater predisposition to central nervous system fatigue, and so they kind of lose their mojo, and they have more, quote, brain fog because estrogen and progesterone also cross the blood-brain barrier. So when we start taking in all these systemic effects of the hormones, when you're looking at low funding or a short timeline, a lot of the research is like, okay, well, we'll do it just on men because we know we can do week and get similar hormone profiles. Or we'll include women just in the low hormone phase when we're very similar to men. So if they are included, then it's not really doing proper research on women because you're not looking at the effects of that hormone perturbation. And then if it comes an anomaly, they'll factor the women out and they'll just go with the men's results and say, hey, wait a second, we did use women. And this is what we found, but they don't say, well, we didn't test for sex differences or we factored the women out. And then you get into perimenopause and menopause, which is a completely different cadre of problems, or I shouldn't say problems, but for research it is, because you have just a change over what's happening again with the hormones as they drop off and how that might affect different things. So when you look at the overarching idea of research, younger women are primarily excluded from sport and exercise science research. And then when you start looking at the aging population, it's almost all done on women, because they're looking at the sudden upsurge of obesity and diabetes and cardiovascular risk factors that happen at the onset of menopause, where men don't have that sudden drop of hormones. So then if you're looking for male research in aging, it's primarily bone research in 80 and 90-year-olds. So it's this weird shift that happens. And then when you're looking at the research too, a lot of things that happen in clinical research gets pulled over to sport and exercise without really being viable. So a lot of the clinical research on sedentary, obese individuals, so this is kind of like, you know, where all the fad diets come in, the intermittent fasting, the keto, some of those things all started in a clinical population, and then they get pulled over without the proper research, right? So then that confuses the messaging again. So it's difficult to tease out, but with the NIH mandate saying you have to include women, more and more research is coming out that does include women and a proper scientific design. There's a small group of us that are actually doing women-specific performance research in the health and fitness aspect, looking at long-term health versus performance or just performance. So it's coming. It's just hard to tease out at the moment because of these issues that happen with scientific design.
Wow. That is an in-depth explanation of what's going on. Thanks so much for that. Let's. I think we've set the stage appropriately. And of course, I'll mention that your book is an excellent resource, Roar. I have not dove into it yet because I'm so busy recording podcasts and dealing with coaching. I shouldn't say dealing, but helping, guiding my coaching clients to breakthrough. But I haven't had a chance to sit around and just read, but it's on my list and has been. But if you're listening right now and you're already, your curiosity is piqued and you're a woman and who wants to understand this, you really want to check out Stacy's book, because just everybody says amazing things about it. So Stacy, let's get into some of the specifics for someone listening right now. Let's take a woman who's, let's say, before menopause, right? She's in the gym. She thinks that it's her hormones that are making her fat. She thinks she's got to do high intensity interval training, even though when she tries it, she just feels burnt out. Can you talk a little bit about, of course, you know, you're an expert and you've dealt with people. You're not just a researcher who makes generalizations to big groups of people, but on these podcasts, even though I'm a very like, hey, let's customize things for you.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
And you even mentioned like, I don't tell people, I used to tell people what to do for the first probably decade of my experience as a coach. But now my clients say, hey, tell me what to do. Why are you asking me all these questions? It's like, no, you're going to tell me. I already spent 10 years telling people what to do. It didn't work out that well.
Yeah.
I need to hear from you first.
Yep.
And then I'll tell you what to do after that.
Yep.
But can you, let's make some sweeping generalizations here to at least give a direction that women who are struggling with this stuff can start to understand themselves better and understand how health and fitness applies to them.
Yeah, for sure.
And
for sure. I mean, one of the easiest things for women to do, even if they're on an oral contraceptive pill, which is another whole thing and issue in itself, is to track your cycle. So getting a hold of one of the apps, like the Fitter Woman app, I think even Hello Clue, or I think Google has one, or even recording it on paper versus your training. So doing it for about 3 months is going to give you some really good insight of how you're feeling on particular days in accordance to what your cycle is. So a lot of people or a lot of women will feel really fantastic either the day before, the day of, or the day after their period starts. Depends on how long it takes for those hormones to drop. And this is also where we look and say, well, we know that we can work with our physiology here, so we can do the high intensity stuff and recover much better. Just because these hormones are lower, our body responds a lot better. So we can access high intensity because we can access carbohydrate better. We recover better because we don't have as much progesterone to break down muscle tissue. So in those low hormone days, and you'll see this as you're tracking your cycle, you'll feel really fantastic. And then around ovulation, some women feel bulletproof and can hit PRs in the gym. Other women feel absolutely flat. And then as you start to get closer to your period, about the 5 days before your period starts, this is where a lot of women feel fat, bloated, flat, have really difficult time hitting intensities, feel like they're not recovering well, not sleeping well. And this is an aspect of how the hormones are affecting all those other systems in the body. So just by biohacking a little bit, by tracking your cycle and writing down your training and your mood and over your cycle, you get such great insight. And I always say 3 months because, you know, you might have an anomaly with 2 months, but 3 gives you really good insight. And from there, you can start working with your coach or your running group or whomever you're working with and say, okay, well, we're all here. Let's hit those intensities because we know we're going to maximize those adaptations today because we can hit that back end of that intensity session and recover really well. And the whole idea of training hard is to stress the body and overcome that stress. But if you're trying to do that when your hormones are elevated and you feel flat and tired, you're kind of hitting a brick wall where you're not going to be able to hit the intensities high enough to garner that stress and adaptation. You're just going to end up with elevated cortisol and stimulus for putting on body fat. So, you know, feeling out how you are against your cycle is pretty refreshing and empowering for a lot of women.
It makes it from something that's maybe like, oh God, I feel bad today. Oh, I'm feeling fat today, to something like, oh, this is something that happens every month. And now I'm starting to understand it's just a repeating pattern.
Yeah.
And let me just make sure I understood you correctly. You're saying based on the phase of the cycle that the menstrual cycle that a woman's in, she'll feel differently.
Yeah.
But how differently has to do with her as an individual? There are some generalizations, really needs to be individualized. Did I understand you correctly there?
Yes. 100%. Because some women are estrogen sensitive, some women are progesterone sensitive. Sometimes the ratios are a little bit different. You start training harder or more intensely or adding a couple of more sessions in during the week, you could get into a little bit of low energy availability, which can perturb the hormones. So you'll have a time where you're feeling a bit flat, but if you eat more, then you overcome it. So yeah, keeping track of your cycle and your training, again, will give really good insight.
And you mentioned if you eat a little bit more, you feel better. I feel like, okay, this is totally anecdotal, right? But I'm just going to throw it out there. I've had a woman ask me before, like she was doing intermittent fasting, mm-hmm. and she was working out hard. And she said, well, on the days that I work out hard, I just feel terrible when I do intermittent fasting, you know, of course, yeah. right? If you're yeah. used to eating. I'm not a big fan of fasted workouts in general, but a lot of women feel like this whole situation where they're trying to exercise more, eat less, which is sensible advice, but sometimes gets taken to an extreme. Are there any particular nutrition approaches that women should be wary of, or how should women think about, in particular, the things that are popular right now? Intermittent fasting, ketogenic diet, paleo diet. We don't need to dive too deep into each of them, but just do you have something to offer there, some advice to offer with that?
Yeah, so I'll be on the high point looking down and give some points into some of those specific diets. But the way I approach it for all my athletes, men and women, because primarily they're all interested in changing body composition, is fuel for the session, right? Because if we, again, take it back a step from a physiological perspective, when you go to exercise, it's a huge stress on the body. And if you're going in fasted or underfueled or not fueling for an endurance aspect within that, you're creating more stress than is needed to garner those fitness adaptations. So it takes longer to recover. And when we think about the catabolism or being in that catabolic state, the longer a woman in particular is in that catabolic state, even within one day, the more hormone perturbation she has. So if a woman is in a low energy available state for even 4 days in a row, she'll start to get thyroid dysfunction. And the first thing that happens is your resting metabolic rate goes down. So women are like fasted or trying to work out fasted. They're increasing cortisol. They're in this catabolic state. The thyroid and metabolism get reset in a conservation mode. So then they start, you know, why am I putting weight on? Why am I not losing weight? Why is my period irregular? Why am I not sleeping well? And it has to do with this kind of your body's not in a protective recovery mode or a regeneration mode, which a lot of people are thinking from intermittent fasting. They're actually in this low energy state and their body's in this pure catabolic state trying to be like, survive, survive, survive. So this is where when you look across all the diet trends, and I've used that word and gotten backlash, it's not trend, it's a lifestyle, which in a case it is. But if you look across the board, in order to get the best benefit from exercise with a dietary intervention is to fuel for the stress and then manipulate your diet around it. If you look at all the research across the board, it comes down to energy availability for that particular exercise stress. And if you're not getting into supporting that exercise stress, then you get a whole quagmire of hormone disruption that has cascading events down the line. And that's what I try to explain to both my male and female athletes is fuel for the session, recover well, and manipulate the rest of it.
Yeah, this brings up something so important. So what most people, your average layperson, views as a productive session is when they're just driven into the ground, yeah. right? It's a very common perception, like, oh, it was such a good workout. I went to CrossFit or did my boot camp or whatever it was, right? And I think people, or I don't think, I know people confuse the difference between having a very productive workout that leads to quantifiable progress versus I got the shit kicked out of me because it was because I was in a certain phase of my menstrual cycle, if it's a woman, and like the workout was killer hard, but it wasn't because it was a productive workout and you were performing well. It was because you're in this state where your performance was just lowered. Or if you take a guy and he's not fueled properly for a very, say, anaerobic, glycolytic, in other words, an activity that you need a lot of carbohydrates for, right? Like mixed, like MMA or Brazilian jiu-jitsu or something.
Yeah.
And you're like, whoa, that was such a good workout. I was just dying. I got really pushed to my limit. But the truth is you didn't get pushed to your limit. You weren't performing anywhere near your limit because you weren't, maybe you recovered enough. You weren't fueled enough. And I think making that distinction is something so critical for people who are just in the mentality that, oh, if it's hard, if I'm getting my sweat on, it's got to be a good, if I'm so sore for 3 days after, it's got to be a good workout. Can you talk a little bit about your perspective on that and maybe share how someone listening can start to be more objective about their workout program, nutrition program, and results instead of just like, hey, I got my ass kicked. That was great.
Yeah. So I come from the endurance world and we always have this saying, slow down to go fast, because there's such that metric of like, I'm going on a group ride. I got to chase the cyclists on my long, slow day. Right. And so they're not doing the appropriate training. They're always in this gray zone of going too hard to be, or going too easy to be hard and too hard to be easy. But in order to go harder and hit that top end, you have to have that easy bit. And people ruin that easy bit so much, right? Because, I mean, now I'm into more functional fitness and stuff, and I see people going to CrossFit every day, 7 days in a row, and then they get broken, right? They're tired. Their technique sucks. They have, like, sore muscles, so they try to compensate. They're not recovering well. They're not sleeping well. And then they're out with an injury for months at a time, right? So it's like taking a hold of it and understanding the reason why you are going to a session. Why am I doing CrossFit? Is it short on time and I really feel fantastic when I hit that high end? Is it that group scenario, or why are you going to the evening running group? Is it for that social support? What is it? What is the driver behind it? And I don't think people understand that. They don't understand what the drive is. They're like, oh, I've got to go. Well, why? Is it because
I feel amazing afterwards?
Yeah. Or is it the social drive, right? I got to go, because if I don't go, they're going to think that I'm weak because I didn't show up to the session, which I hear a lot too. I have to go because I have to. Why? Because if I don't go, then I'm perceived as being weak. And it's not that. It's taking care of your body, listening to your body. And it's taken me, oh gosh, I'm facing down the barrel of 50 rather than the barrel of 40, but it's taken me decades to understand that within myself and be able to teach my students and my mentees that same thing. It's like understanding what the driver is and why you're doing something. And then when you take it back to a fueling aspect, you don't have to go fuel for an hour easy swim, right? You can use your breakfast and your lunch for the fuel for that. But if you're going to go look and go into a CrossFit session at 6 a.m., you need something beforehand. Otherwise, you're just going to go in a catabolic state and create a greater catabolic state, and you're not ever going to get any fitter. You're just going to get sick, tired, and injured.
Yeah, well said. And what do you think about the idea? I had a Dr. Mike T. Nelson on, and he talks about metabolic flexibility. And one of the easy sort of things he likes to do is if you're doing something like an easy day where you're hitting your aerobic exercise, you're not really pushing your heart rate up. He likes to go a little bit lower carbohydrate because you're mostly burning fat. If you're staying in that aerobic zone, you're tapping more into fat as fuel, and versus something that's going to be more like glycolytic is the proper term for those of you who are listening. But that means you're going to burn more carbohydrates for energy. It's that burning that you feel in your muscles when you're doing weightlifting until muscular fatigue, or doing like hard intervals where your muscles are just on fire. You're like, ah, oh, this sucks. What do you think about that? And what can you tell us about that?
Yeah.
What your thoughts are?
So this comes back down to people thinking that I need to eat the same thing every day, right? And it's been drilled into us from so many years of eat breakfast, lunch, dinner, some snacks, breakfast, lunch, dinner, some snacks, regardless of what you're doing. But your appetite and your energy needs are very dynamic. And so if you're looking at what is your goal, are you exercising for health, or are you exercising for performance? If you're exercising for health to increase mitochondrial adaptation so your body burns more fat when you're sitting around, then yeah, go lower on the carbohydrates, especially if you're a guy. But again, recover well. You don't have to have protein shakes or special food or anything like that. Use your real meal, what you're doing, right? But if you're going to go for 2 days or really hard, intense session, fuel your body for it, right? Then your appetite and your macronutrient needs change. So it's not about eating the same thing every day, day in, day out, because that's what's expected. And then trying to do training and not really planning the two together. Because again, appetites are dynamic. Training is very dynamic. And then when you add on the menstrual cycle, that adds another layer. But I think we've gotten into the situation where no one really wants to think for themselves so much. So they're just like, boom, going to do this, boom, going to do that.
Well, it's hard work, Stacey.
When
you're talking about it, it's like, okay, let's calculate your macros for your 2-a-day. And then let's calculate the macros for your rest day. By the way, I think an important thing too, And for those of you listening, like, just hire a coach. Jesus.
Yeah.
You know? Stop trying to figure this stuff out on your own.
Yeah.
I think something that's also important for my particular group of people who listen to this show, keep coming back to listen, is that, we've been talking a lot about fueling for performance. However, a lot of them live very sedentary lives. So, and I know, you mostly work with athletes and stuff, but what would you say to someone who's not very active and maybe thinks that cortisol, high levels of cortisol are making them fat, or for both men and women there, mm-hmm. or for women in particular, that there are some sort of hormonal shifts that happen that make them fat? Can you speak to that?
Yeah. So I did my postdoc in prevention medicine, and I continue to work in the community and work with a lot of women who are, they're moms or they're career women, or they're just trying to exercise for health. Right. And they're not high performance athletes. So that's, I sit kind of in the middle. And when I'm working with the general community and talking about it, it's like, it's not about making sure that you're hitting the calorie needs of that session, right? It's about eating a very low on the food chain, diverse intake of fruits and veg to meet your health needs. And then exercise is not for calorie burn per se, because when you go run for an hour, it's a minuscule amount of calories burned compared to what people consume. So when you break that mentality of exercise is calorie burn, then people don't think, oh, I went for a 30-minute jog, I can eat whatever I want. And so it's getting people to understand that the goal of exercise and the health aspect is to create that stress on the body to make the body stronger and more resilient for long-term health. So again, you're getting those mitochondrial adaptations. You are getting some genetic expression to help with heart health and to help with like blood glucose control. And so all of those things that you want to maintain your health, that's what your exercise is for. So when people are like, oh, I have elevated cortisol and I'm really stressed out and that's why I'm putting fat on, a lot of times, one, they're going in fasted training. So yeah, they will have elevated cortisol, but because they've gone in fasted and done some fasted training, they get really hungry later in the day and overcompensate. So again, when we start to break that idea of burning calories through exercise is allowing me to eat whatever I want or allowing me to have more treats in a day, you break that mentality, then it becomes much easier for people to assimilate good dietary practices and exercise for health. Because, you know, we say you cannot outrun a bad diet, right? And so many people try to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. And especially with how bad, I mean, I did that in my 20s, but I was training jiu-jitsu like crazy, lifting weights probably 6 times a week. I was also feeling beat to shit.
Yeah.
And in a lot of chronic pain.
Yeah.
And it wasn't sustainable. But I was drinking, going out drinking, you know, ridiculous amounts of alcohol in Miami Beach. But thanks for explaining that. Let's talk a little bit about menopause, because actually a lot of the women who I've spoken to listen to this show, they're either have already gone through it or they're on that journey, right? That journey, that change that is not that far away for them. And one of the things I hear from my clients who've gone through menopause is that they noticed a change in their body.
Yes.
Like it's such a common thing to hear. Like, I went through menopause, I noticed a change in my body. Can you speak to like, what are those changes? Can you explain them for us? And what a woman who's in that stage of her life can do to reclaim her health and not feel like a victim to this natural physiological process?
Yeah. So some of the bigger things that happen is we become more sensitive to carbohydrate and we put on a lot of abdominal adiposity. And so a lot of belly fat. And part of it is because of the way the hormones can mediate blood glucose control and fatty acid utilization. Estrogen really increases fatty acid utilization. So when you lose some of that stimulus, then your body's like, now I'm going to put it on. So you start to put on more belly fat. And again, like I said, you become more sensitive to carbohydrate, which is why women start to get metabolic syndrome or type 2 diabetes after menopause sets in. The other aspect is we lose the anabolic stimulus of estrogen for lean mass development. And women will lose a lot of lean mass as well as bone mass the first 5 years after the onset of menopause if they're not paying attention to what kind of training they're doing. So when women approach me in perimenopause or just on the onset of menopause, I'm like, we need to do some plyometric work. We need to do that high intensity, not that low endurance stuff. We need to stimulate muscle from a neuromuscular aspect to maintain that lean mass. And increasing protein intake, and your carbohydrate should be primarily from fruit and veg, not the grains, not the breads and the pastas and, you know, what a lot of people who are in that set came through, you know, the 80s of the low carbohydrate or the low fat, high carbohydrate diet, right? Trying to dissuade them from that. And there's a significant improvement that I found in my women who are adding some adaptogens in. So they're using ashwagandha, they're using shishandra, they're using maca to kind of help mediate some of those hormone imbalances because they've lost those hormones, as well as putting in power-based training. Then they don't put on the belly fat. They don't have the issues sleeping. They can preserve lean mass, and some actually put on lean mass. And then the hardest one to work with is a vegan woman going through menopause because trying to find ways of getting enough leucine in with the plyo training to stimulate the muscle protein synthesis. But it's very doable. So women who say, my body's changed, I don't have heat tolerance, I have problems sleeping and putting on belly fat, the first thing that I have them do is get on some adaptogens and use tart cherry juice for sleep and put in that plyo training. And it helps so much, significant amount of help there.
I've also, thanks for sharing that. I've also heard that some people recommend using like soy isoflavones to try to help with diminishing estrogen level. So is that something that you found either in the research or with your clients that works for hot flashes and sleep?
there isn't any empirical evidence that shows that it does. Sometimes it works for some women and it doesn't work for others. And I think the biggest disservice that's been put out there from the medical community is telling women to eat soy, especially if you're going through menopause, because then women will increase their soy protein intake. But the leucine and the branched-chain amino acid profile of soy products is not enough to tip them into that muscle protein synthesis. And the isoflavine, it's a moot point because you can use black cohosh instead, which really mitigates your hot flash and vasomotor symptoms. And if you stack that with some of the, you know, more common adaptogens like the maca in your maca smoothie and your ashwagandha, then your vasomotor symptoms are taken care of in staying away from the soy isoflavones. So, you know, when I look at some of the research that's come out from NHANES and the complementary alternative medicine branch of NIH, there's nothing there that says that that's the be-all, end-all. It's just a disservice that the medical community has pushed out.
Gotcha. Okay. Tell me how you really feel about that, Stacey.
I'm not a big soy fan. We could go on and on about the sustainability and the food policy aspects of soy, but we'll leave that for my nutrition class.
All right, you got it. No, I appreciate that because it is really difficult to, now I appreciate you as a professional writing that line between academia and, you know, real world results, because we don't have enough of those. And also I appreciate that, there's a lot of people that sometimes get too into their, you know, guru status and buy into their own bullshit a little bit too much. And I don't get that vibe from speaking to you or listening when I've heard interviews with you at all. And I really appreciate that because we need more people like that. That's how I try to be.
Yeah.
Right. You know, just getting people results. That's what matters. And,
right. Making people feel better so that they have a better quality of life. Right. I mean, because I stare down, I'm like, my grandmother's living by herself at 102 years old. So it's like, if I get to be that old, I hope my quality of life is pretty good. And I want my friends to have that good quality of life. So they're there too. It's all selfish. I just want everyone to feel good so they can come along for the ride.
Me too. Well said. One thing I want to ask you about that doesn't have to do with so much of the science-y aspect is, I guess our issues around like aging in general and health in general, and maybe looking to exercise and nutrition as a way to kind of heal or cope with other things in our life that aren't going our way. And for example, you mentioned when we were talking about CrossFit, the community aspect, and now all this. We've kind of always known like social isolation and loneliness is not a good thing, right?
Right.
But now it's coming out that it raises inflammation levels and it's like really terrible and maybe as bad for you as smoking. I forget the number of cigarettes, but like 15 cigarettes or something, you know, which may not be exactly accurate, but you know, it's bad for you, period.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that doesn't get enough. You know, because how do you sell that? How do you sell making friends, right?
I know. And men
you have to actually do the work.
Yeah, I know.
What's
men
that?
Men are notorious for not making friends when they get older. It's really interesting. So, yeah.
Yeah, my dad's a little bit like that.
Yeah. It's the whole social cultural aspect that people forget, because we often say, like, you have the ruler heads and the storytellers, and the ruler heads are like the bench science, the physiologists, they're all looking from the biochemical aspect. And then the storytellers are the sociocultural aspect. But when you bring them together, it gives you so much more insight. It's like, yeah, I say people go to CrossFit because they feel the pressure to go. And if they're not there, then, you know, they're determined to be weak. But it's really, I'm going because I'm going to see my friends or I'm part of that environment. And it's finding other ways as well. It's not just going to the class, it's going to the box. Everyone's like, I'm to my box. What box is your affiliate? So it's very much an identity thing as well. And it kind of falls over to some of the diet trends too. Because you notice that, like, I'll say I'm a scientist and I'm a vegetarian, right? But people identify themselves as who they are and what they are through their work, their sport, and their dietary preference. So if you try to go to a party and tell who you are, what you are without using those three, it's really difficult because they're so ingrained in how we see ourselves, right? And yeah, and part of it is you find your people by these common things. And so it's like trying to find your people, not in just one angle, but find your people in many different angles to support you.
Yeah. Any thoughts on how to do that better?
No, that's a work in progress, really. Like, it's always changing and evolving, and like, social media is so isolating, and there's so many people that are just latched to social media and the impact on that. And I say that because one of my colleagues here, Holly Thorpe, she does a lot of the sociocultural aspect of women in extreme sports and watching social media and the trends and the isolation and even like the Instagram and seeing now people are going to their physicians because they want to look like their Instagram picture. And it's a very interesting and fast moving research area. And how do you like make friends when you're already isolated from social media? That's the big question.
Yeah. Important stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I have one more question for you if you have the time for it.
Sure.
I would like to ask you, what's the biggest, we've talked a lot today about all types of things, about, you know, about the different experts, quote unquote experts coming out there and promoting a certain type of training or nutrition approach. We've talked about, you know, how women have been kind of marginalized and not a lot of research has come out because of some of the more difficulties that arise when you're having women in different phases of their cycle. We've talked about menopause and perimenopause. What is the biggest take through or biggest message that you'd like a woman listening to this right now to take away from our time today?
To empower yourself by listening to yourself. That's the basic premise, because we're so detached of how we feel and trying to look in an external cue for how we feel. But if we pull it internally and say, well, maybe it is the phase of my cycle, or maybe it's more because I didn't sleep well, and trying to understand those internal cues a bit more will allow women to become a bit more empowered for their nutrition and exercise choices. And when I say this, because I do a lot of talks and conferences and that kind of stuff, and so I see all the research, and they're always external cues. And then now I start conversations with, how are you feeling right now? And people are like, I'm sleeping well. No, how do you really feel? What's the internal cues? And we're so turned off from it. So once you start getting back into like tracking and understanding how you feel based on other external and internal parameters, it opens up a whole new world. And you can really start to, what's the term that a lot of people use, and I've probably used it before, is biohack, right? So you can understand what's happening to you.
I like that term. Right? A lot of our fellow fitness people don't like that term.
Oh, I love it.
But I like that term. I love it.
It's taken, you know, a little bit of the data points and bringing it inside to make those educated choices that's going to benefit you in the long run instead of, you know, like even your twin, right? Because your twin's even different if you have one. So,
well, Stacey, thank you so much for coming on and sharing all your wisdom and your knowledge today. You know, it's really important what you're doing, not just with women in particular, but also just with the type of person you are and trying to help get rid of those, get or help to provide a lighthouse in all the fog of misinformation that is out there right now that just has people so confused. So thank you so much for what you do. And if you would like to buy Stacey's book, is called Roar, R-O-A-R. And it's just, I've heard amazing things about it. I need to get on it, especially after speaking to you, Stacey. I'm like, I need to get on this. Where would you like people to go and connect with you or reach out to you?
You know, as much as I bash social media, I am on it. The Dr. Stacey Sims Facebook page. Also, Twitter is the Dr. Stacey Sims, and Instagram as well. It's all Dr. Stacey Sims. You can find me in any of those channels. And most often, I will be the one that's answering. And even though I have someone who does my social media for me, I answer the questions and try to connect as much as I can. Thank you, Ted, so much for having me on. This has been a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we've got to do it again soon. We're just scratching the surface here.
We could talk for hours, I'm sure.
Thanks so much. That wraps up another episode of the Legendary Life Podcast. And I hope you enjoyed this episode today with Dr. Stacy Sims. She is just a wealth of information on the differences between women and men and how they should approach their training and nutrition. And I learned so much, and I can't wait to have her back on the show. I'd have to say the biggest takeaway for me is how Stacy was saying that women should track their menstrual cycle and match up what they feel physiologically with the phase that they're in menstruation. That's something that can help you dial in your training and nutrition even more so that you understand, oh, well, this is what happens during this phase. And it becomes less like a mystical sort of thing where you're not sure what's going to happen or how you feel. And then all of a sudden it becomes a predictable cycle where you understand the effects that it's having on your cravings, on your ability to push yourself on the gym and recover from all that exercise. Great stuff, and can't wait to have a round two with her to dive in deeper. Before we say goodbye, I just want to recommend and remind you to go to Organifi.com to receive 20% off your first order. This is the best green powder I have ever tasted. I've tried so many of them on the market. Some of them are very high quality, but they taste awful. And it's not something I can recommend because I know my clients won't drink it. But this stuff, it's legit and it tastes great. But again, don't believe me. Try it for yourself. Go to Organifi.com. That's Organifi.com. And use the code TED20. That's TED20. To receive 20% off your first order. Again, this is a limited time discount for Legendary Life listeners. So go ahead, use the discount code, enjoy some green juice, and I'd love to hear from you. Did you enjoy it and notice a difference when you started adding it to your routine? That's all I've got. Hope you enjoyed this episode and have an amazing week.